From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Equal justice is a foundation of the legal world and of our society.
But when it comes to the application of law, justice isn't always equal. Today, stories about the law, from the rights of non-English-speaking jurors to a place where the divide between rich and poor is especially obvious, civil court. And my interview with Marty Castro, the first Latino to chair the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights.
The people who were influencing national politics were all lawyers, and they were mostly white men. And I thought, you know what? I want to be a lawyer just like them, because I want to be able to have an impact on my community.
All this coming up on Latino USA as we ask the question, do you know your rights? I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Latino USA podcast. Here are a few questions for you, though. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals, or that John Waters was a judge at the pornography Oscars? Well, you would know that if you listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and you'll discover new ones to follow. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today we're talking about rights. So what better place to start than in a courtroom?
And the case isn't information. Okay.
But this isn't your average courtroom. Okay. And it doesn't look like the imposing courtrooms that you see on television. Nope. Here there are big windows that let lots of light in. And the judge's bench isn't above, but rather sits at eye level with the defendants.
You'll notice I ask in every case, I say, for the adjourn date, is that a good date for you to come back? Behind that question is, I respect you. I respect your time. I respect that you have a life outside of this case and other things happening with jobs, with childcare, et cetera.
So it seems like any date would probably work. They're asking for the 7th. What's a good day of the week for you to come back to court Monday through Friday? Yeah, Fridays are okay. I would think you're kind of...
Yeah. Alex Calabrese is the head judge at the Red Hook Community Justice Center in Brooklyn. And he runs his courtroom on the principle of something called procedural justice.
Courts across the country just pick dates convenient for the court and convenient to the lawyers. Nobody's asking the defendants, is that a good date for you?
Procedural justice is an alternative form of justice that looks at the psychology behind why people obey or don't obey the law. It was developed in the 1970s, but recently has been picking up steam. The idea is pretty simple, respect and fairness. So if defendants feel like they're being treated fairly and that their voices matter, then they'll be more likely to comply with their sentencing. And it's the little things here that kind of matter. For example, listen to Judge Calabrese's tone when he asks the defendant what he thinks about his rehab program.
You went to the intake for Realization Center, and I mean, I know you just went to the intake. What do you think about the program?
Yeah, they talked to me too.
Okay.
Also, I mean, they're trying to help me.
Defendants check in often to discuss their progress. Instead of prison sentences, they might be given anger management sessions or long-term drug rehab. Calabrese believes that this model can help stop the cycle of arrests and rearrests. Before he worked in Red Hook, he was at a traditional court.
So I felt like I was just, to a certain extent, just churning cases. We had offenders doing life in prison 30 days at a time. And you might as well just schedule their next arrest because you knew it was coming because you weren't getting to the issue that brought the offender to court.
Sometimes it's easy to forget that the legal system isn't just about putting people behind bars. If you ask almost anyone working in the law, I bet they'd say the same thing. It's about delivering justice. But what exactly does justice mean? We asked Judge Calabresi for his definition.
Justice is fairness from day one. It's respect for the court system. It's respect for the job that the police officers have to do. It's respect for the community. And it's respect for the offender. Each and every time he or she is in court. And underlying all that is fairness. I think at the end, with that approach, you get justice.
Today on Latino USA, stories about people like Judge Calabresi working towards a more just and more equal application of the law. From a mother in East LA fighting for her autistic children's education to tenants taking on landlords in order to save their homes. But first, we turn towards a part of the court system that all citizens have to deal with at one point or another. Of course, I'm talking about jury duty. Now, imagine what it would be like serving on a jury if you aren't fluent in English. Our Latino USA intern, Isabel Rio Frio, has been looking into issues around juries and language.
There is no official language in the United States, but in court, things are a bit different. The U.S. court system is exclusively run in English. In theory, all citizens have a constitutional right to serve on a jury, but most courts have some kind of rule about the English proficiency of jurors. And in practice, non-English-speaking jurors are often excluded from the jury box.
Language in the United States is closely connected with race, national origin, ethnicity. But our legal system treats it as if it's just some kind of general neutral rule, like a procedural rule. Let's all speak in English without recognizing the impact it has on people of color, particularly Latinos.
This is Jasmine Gonzalez-Rose, a professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. She has studied the exclusion of non-English-speaking jurors for over 5 years. But it was a particular experience she had in Puerto Rico that got her thinking about who was sitting on the jury box.
I was clerking at the U.S. District Court for the District of Puerto Rico, which is the federal court in Puerto Rico. And a veteran court employee looks out down the hall and says, "Mira, that juror looks like a criminal defendant." She meant that juror was Black.
And what she found in the mainland U.S. wasn't that much different.
We see people of color not appearing in the jury box, primarily Latinos. But what do we see over in the defendant's chair? We see an overrepresentation of Latino defendants.
The concept of having a non-English-speaking juror in court is not new to the United States at all. The American colonies included non-English speakers as jurors for hundreds of years, and Spanish speakers served on juries through interpreters in the Southwest until the early 20th century. But things have changed. Today, federal courts require jurors to speak, read, write, and understand English. In lower courts, the rules vary by state, and there's a lot of gray area. Some states require jurors just to understand English. Others demand they read and write English as well. And then there are states like California and Nevada that have rules that are really vague, asking for quote-unquote sufficient or competent English. For Jasmine Gonzalez-Rose, the language requirements pose a major problem.
Criminal defendants who have the most to lose when they are sitting trial, they're not having a jury pool that is fairly representative of the community. They're not having the opportunity to be judged by a jury of their peers, which is a fundamental right under the fair cross-section requirement of the Sixth Amendment.
One of the biggest concerns about non-English-speaking jurors is the issue of interpreters. Defendants who don't speak English are provided with interpreters. But whether or not a juror gets an interpreter depends on the presiding judge. Some fear that having a 13th person in the jury deliberation room could influence their decision-making. Marcus Kemmelmeyer, a social psychologist at the University of Nevada, Reno, did a field study to find out if interpreters actually affect the balance of the courtroom. So he went to Las Cruces, New Mexico, and put together a total of 49 mock juries that were either majority Latino or majority Anglo. And after conducting the experiment, Marcus came back with some surprising findings.
The interesting thing is that in the process itself, The Anglo jurors, they seem to enjoy the presence of the non-English-speaking juror and the interpreter. If there was any kind of effect at all, it might have actually been positive.
But what happened when the interpreter went into the deliberation room?
On our juries, the interpreter really faded into the background. It was really a non-person for the purposes of the deliberation of the other jurors.
New Mexico is the only state that guarantees an interpreter for jurors. The state's constitution protects Spanish speakers from being excluded from the jury box because of their inability to speak, read, or write in English.
It makes perfect sense because even people who are not proficient in the English language have the capacity to find facts, to exercise their moral genius, and help their community.
This is Edward Chavez, Justice of the New Mexico Supreme Court. Non-English speakers play a part in basically all other areas of the justice system. They can sue, be sued, can be accused of a crime, or be victims of a crime. So Chavez asks, why can they serve on juries?
I've always thought that justice is a community project, much like perfecting our union is a community project. And there's no reason to exclude people from that community project simply because of their inability to fluently speak the English language.
He says there are easy ways to use an interpreter in court without influencing the trial.
For example, if you wanted to take a straw vote of guilty or not guilty, well, if the non-English speaking juror wrote culpable, then they would know who the juror was that was voting guilt. So what they've done is they, on their own, come up with the idea that they will use a number one for guilty and a number two for not guilty, and that way they preserve the confidentiality of the juror.
Paula Gausello works at the New Mexico Center for Language Access, a program that certifies interpreters for the state courts. She says that interpreters must be certified and have to take an oath in court before serving during a trial.
In our state, we have close to 100 interpreters. Most of them are, of course, for Spanish. That's our first language.
Almost half of the population in New Mexico speaks Spanish, although interpreters also work in Navajo and English if needed. Here is Justice Chavez again.
Is there any real reason why you would exclude somebody who is not proficient in the English language from participating in the jury system, the only system where in our democracy we can compel citizens to participate?
All right, Isabel, so you speak English super well, but you're not a native speaker. So if you ended up serving on a jury, how would you feel about that?
I think I would be really nervous, actually. When I imagine myself sitting in court, I imagine myself hearing a lot of hard words, maybe words that I'm not familiar with, and maybe words that I've never used in English.
I actually love serving on juries. I look forward to getting called. And I look forward to actually getting on a jury because I see it as my civic duty. And I do see it as I am a jury of, I'm your peer. I'm sure there are many people who don't speak fluent English, who are citizens, who probably also would like to look forward to serving on a jury.
Jury duty is one of those rights that, you know, you have to do it. You cannot be forced to vote. You cannot be forced to run for office. But you have to go to jury duty. And this is basically one of those concepts that makes up for democracy. You can actually serve and participate in democracy, be active. So excluding a group from this, it's a very big deal.
Thanks, Isabel, for your reporting on this issue. It's really important. And coming up on our show, the challenges facing low-income communities in civil court.
There is a justice gap in this country between the finite legal resources that are available and the desperate need for legal services by the poor and people of modest means.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
en las últimas horas del día, viendo el sol que se esconde en el mar. Una noche más yéndose el día, me gustaría a mí que estuvieras acá. No hace falta perder la cabeza, no hace falta dejar de comer. Dando vueltas sobre este planeta, lo haces, deshaces y lo vuelves a hacer. Los momentos después de contarte, tu cara de sorpresa al saber. No hace falta tener tanto miedo, que el fuego recorra la cabeza, los pies. No hace falta que quedes afuera, no hace falta que puedas...
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to our podcast. Makes us so happy to know you're there. But before we get back to our show, I want to take a moment to thank everyone who has donated to us by going to latinousa.org and doing something simple like clicking on the donate button. Many of you have told us why you donate, and it always goes back to us telling stories that are important to you from a perspective that you don't always hear. So your donations really help us to do that. If you haven't donated, please consider doing so and joining your fellow Latino USA listeners in enabling us to bring you stories like the ones you're listening to today. And if you can, take a second to rate and review our show on iTunes. It really helps us to continue to grow our program. Speaking of which, let's get right back to it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Jane and Gerald Catcher, supporting the Children's Movement of Florida, dedicated to helping all children enter school with the social, emotional, and intellectual skills needed to succeed. More information is available at childrensmovementflorida.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, stories about the legal system, part of the government that is meant to provide justice for all, but in some circumstances, it seems to provide justice for only some. All children living in the U.S. have the right to a free public education. And yet, for one mother in East Los Angeles, getting her son into a classroom that actually suited his needs wasn't easy. Our producer, Antonia Cerejido, brings us this story from Los Angeles.
I met Josefina Nieves at the offices of Fiesta Educativa in Montecito Heights. Fiesta Educativa, which means education party, is an organization that provides information for the families of autistic children, in particular Latino and Asian families. Josefina immediately started telling me about her son, Nestor.
He tells me, he just told me actually 2 days ago, everybody is having a girlfriend and I'm the only one who's not.
Like a lot of moms, there's a part of Josefina that can't believe more girls aren't all over her son.
A 21-year-old that is really handsome. My son, I always say that. 6'2", really nice.
But Josefina knows all about her son's challenges.
He said, I'm trying to get over my autism. And I say, well, you will get to that when you find the right one. And of course, I tried to do my mom speech. But on the side, I think he's right, because of the autism, it's really hard for him to really do a conversation both ways.
Nestor is autistic, and that means this whole girlfriend thing is pretty confusing.
I feel like I want one so I could, like, fit in more and say I have one, but I honestly don't know what it's like, so I can't imagine if I would like it or not.
When I talk to Nestor, I ask him to just describe his mom.
She's a very hardworking woman. She helps me out a lot with everything, and she has blonde hair. She wears formal clothing, and I think that's it.
Nestor's autism is mild. He can hold a conversation, but as you can probably tell, he can take things pretty literally. It can put a strain on relationships.
I don't have many friends to go out with.
Autism is a spectrum. It can mean having some trouble reading and relating to others, or on the other end, it can mean not being able to speak or control your behavior. Like Josefina's younger son, Danny, who's also autistic.
He will scream. He doesn't have any language, so he will scream, he will run, he will hit the wall, he will go under a table. So all the more typical behavior for kids with autism.
1 in 68 children in the general U.S. population is diagnosed with autism, in contrast with only 1 in 93 Hispanic children. There's a debate whether Latinos are actually less likely to have autism or whether they just aren't being properly diagnosed. Either way, autism is still something that is foreign to many Latino communities here in the U.S., including Josefina's.
My brothers and everybody, like, why is he doing that? Why? You're the one. It's your fault. This and that. So it was very hard at the beginning.
So you had family members who actually told you that it was your fault?
Oh, a lot, yeah.
Josefina often felt like she was on her own, taking care of her two boys. Her husband couldn't keep up.
At the beginning, he tried to help me. He tried to understand. But then, because I was the only one going around every places, then he will tell me, you know everything. You know, now you know what to do. You know what to do. So I start doing everything myself.
When Danny was 12, something happened that made Josefina realize that she did need extra help. It was Halloween. Danny was enrolled in a local public school.
He loves Halloween still until now. He was dressed up, I think it was pumpkin. Back then, usually he likes big pumpkins and things like that.
Danny was really excited for the school's Halloween parade, so Josefina dropped him off in his outfit and went on with her day. But that afternoon, Josefina got a call from the school to come pick Danny up.
They say that my son was in the principal's office, already calmed down.
The school didn't give Josefina details of what had happened. They had just told her that during the parade, Danny had been left alone in a classroom and that he had started to act out. At the time, because of his autism, Danny didn't have verbal ability, which would freak Josefina out.
He didn't have language. He couldn't explain to me what happened. He was just mad.
After leaving the principal's office, Josefina found out from another mom that Danny had actually escaped the building. He had run down the street when the school called the police. Josefina couldn't trust the school that had left her son unsupervised and then had to call the police because they couldn't handle him. So she decided to try to put Danny in a smaller private school that would better suit his needs. And thus began her trip down a wormhole of legal paperwork and proceedings. Every child with a mental illness has something called an IEP, or Individual Education Plan. And in order for Josefina to get Danny into a smaller, more personalized school, she had to get his IEP changed.
I decided to go to mediation, which is this first step before you go to a judge.
Josefina presented the school district with evaluations and expert opinions and had really thought they were going to change her son's school.
And they still told me, no, he doesn't need it.
Mediation didn't work. So Josefina took the next step, something called due process. Basically, you show up in front of a judge with a lawyer and try to use expert testimony to try to prove that your child is not getting the education he or she is entitled to by law.
And in 5 minutes with a lawyer, they gave me the program. It was crazy. I tell them, it's unbelievable how the system works.
According to Josefina, a lot of Latino families don't know that they can continue to ask for better service.
You have the right to appeal it. You have to write to go to a judge and all that. They don't usually tell us that.
We reached out to LA Unified and found out how many due process cases there have been in the last year. LA Unified School District is made up of 5 educational service centers that represent different areas in the county. The North Center, that includes the wealthier and historically whiter San Fernando Valley, had over 400 due process cases, while the East, Josefina Center, had less than half of that. Now Danny is in a program that is much more hands-on, and things have gotten easier for him.
Now he can communicate a lot of things that he wants. When he wants to go to the restroom, when he wants water, when he wants to eat, when he wants to go out, Target, all the stores. He loves stores. He loves shopping.
In many ways, Nestor and Danny are really lucky to have Josefina. She managed to navigate the legal system and get them the education they need. But for many parents in Josefina's community, it's hard to find the time or resources to help their children with special needs.
Now we're getting more education for the families, so hopefully that will help.
Nestor, Josefina's older son, recognizes that his mom is the right person to help out.
With her life's experience having 2 children with autism and with varying degrees of severity, I would say she has a good experience to help out others, especially parents.
The lesson, if you don't ask for something, oftentimes you won't get it. It's all about knowing your rights. For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido.
Civil court is often the place where the intimate details of people's lives get decided. Custody hearings, divorce cases, eviction proceedings, foreclosures. People facing these issues often can't afford a lawyer and often don't know how to navigate their way through the court system. That's what happened to Cesar Bello when he ended up in housing court. Earlier this year, the building in Manhattan where Cesar rented was sold, and he was facing losing his home. Julia Alsop picks up the story there.
Bueno.
This is Cesar Bello and his dad, Vincent. The two live with Cesar's wife, two kids, and his mother in New York's East Village. In other words, prime real estate.
Typically for an apartment this size, we offer like 10 grand or something like that, you know, maybe 15 grand.
And that is someone who identifies himself as Newton Hines.
My name is Newton Hines. I'm with the management. We're the new owners of the building.
I can't say for sure that this is the recorded voice of Newton Hines, because a lawsuit related to this tape is currently in court, and Hines has declined to comment to us. Cesar Bello secretly recorded this tape with his iPhone one Saturday afternoon in March. That's when somebody, who may or may not be Newton Hines, and who may or may not have been employed by a property management company, offered Cesar Bello and his father what's known as a buyout.
I think somewhere around 25 for a total package I could get done. You know, I'd have to run it by my partners, but I think we could get 25, but your move would be seamless. Literally, like, you know, you go to bed on Thursday, you on Saturday you're in a totally new place somehow.
Vincent and Cesar currently pay about $1,400 a month for a two-bedroom apartment in a neighborhood where a place like this averages about $3,200. But their apartment is rent-stabilized, meaning the rent can only go up by 1% each year. Landlords who want to raise rents need to get these tenants out, so they hire people called relocation specialists to apply pressure. Like the man in this recording.
We don't want to kick you out. We want to see you out.
They might make special offers.
It's a mix of cash and like services. So let's start with the moving. We'll pay for your moving. It usually ranges anywhere from about $2,500 to $3,000 for an apartment this size.
Or threaten to shut off services.
What I am concerned about is what's going to happen with the construction, because we are filing for a construction permit, which is different than your typical work permit. Construction permit literally turns the building into a construction zone. And what'll begin to happen is, like, water will be shut off for extended periods of time. The heat may be off at times. And it's going to be very uncomfortable.
Or start demolishing the building.
I'm here really to help you. Because if it were up to the owners, they just, like I said, drop dynamite in the whole building and everybody will figure it out.
And then there's always intimidation.
I don't want, you know, your dad thinking that we're threatening police, because that's not what this is about. But explain to him that the criminal stuff that's going on in the building, it's connected between multiple apartments.
Okay.
It's not like it's one apartment.
Okay.
It's like it's practically a drug hotel and some other stuff that's going on in here.
Okay.
You know, some prostitution also.
Okay.
So the way the investigation is going to go, they're going to go building-wide. And
okay.
When they go building-wide, they'll ask everybody whatever, and then they'll carry information and do what they want. So, you know, If someone's illegal, it's going to be a problem for them at that point. It's not a problem for us.
Buyouts themselves aren't illegal, but pressuring tactics like the ones we just learned about are. They're considered harassment, but they're common practice in New York City. In the Bello's case, heavy construction soon began on the building. Heat, hot water, and gas were shut off for 2 months. So the tenants knew they had to do something. They contacted the Urban Justice Center, which offers free legal support to low-income groups. And we're lucky enough to find legal representation with them.
We sued a lot of people in this case. So
that's Stephanie Rudolph. an attorney with the Urban Justice Center. By a lot of people, she means the landlord, his management companies, Newton Hines, and another alleged relocation specialist. The suit charges them with harassment and housing violations.
Harassment happens everywhere. I think in this case it was particularly racialized.
All the parties named in the suit defend themselves in different ways. The landlord says he didn't know the harassment was happening. The management company says it's no longer involved with the building and should be dismissed from the suit. And there are questions about the identity of the man in the recording. In other words,
today was a complicated day.
Everyone knows that in criminal cases, if you can't afford a lawyer, you're assigned one from the state. That's not the deal in civil cases. In civil cases, there's no guaranteed right to a lawyer. So people who can't afford a lawyer or don't know that they qualify for legal aid often go without. In New York City alone, 99% of tenants end up unrepresented in eviction cases. In complex situations like this one, where multiple parties are being sued and everyone is pointing fingers at one another, it's really difficult to wade through the legal system by yourself.
There is a justice gap in this country between the finite legal resources that are available and the desperate need for legal services by the poor and people of modest means.
That's Jonathan Lippman. He's the chief judge of New York State Court of Appeals.
The lack of legal representation is literally causing people to fall off a cliff and just so traumatically affecting their lives.
One of his biggest priorities is closing the justice gap.
Equal justice is a foundation of the legal world and of our society.
In order to improve access to legal services, Lippman has implemented several different policy and funding innovations. Things like mandatory pro bono hours, that is, working for free, for law students taking the bar.
If aspiring lawyers, students, are not going to embrace the core values of our profession, then they're not going to be lawyers in New York, because what being a lawyer is about is helping people.
Another idea is investing in legal aid.
$85 million this year in public funding for legal services for the poor.
Or expanding the role of non-lawyers to guide people through the court system.
They provide the moral support. They answer questions that the judge might ask them. They are trained in a particular area, like foreclosure or eviction.
Though New York State is making strides tackling the justice gap, the problem is nationwide. According to the Justice Index, a national database run by the Cardozo Law School, there's only one lawyer for every 8,893 low-income Americans who qualify for legal aid. That makes some advocates, like Judge Lippman, say that the right to a lawyer for civil cases should be guaranteed, the same as it is for criminal cases.
A lot of people might not only be surprised by that tape, you know, being offered or pressured to take a buyout for your apartment in your rent control apartment in New York City. But I think a lot of people, and I know that when I kind of came upon this, when you realize that you don't have access to a lawyer when you're in civil court, that is pretty surprising for a lot of people. And we think that in the United States, something happens, you end up in court, you must have access to a lawyer.
Right. So in the pop cultural hive mind that you have a right to a lawyer, you hear it on TV dramas, getting read your Miranda rights. But what's really interesting is that the right to a lawyer, even in criminal cases, is actually a fairly new concept. The ruling Gideon versus Wainwright was handed down in 1963.
So 1963 was Gideon. Don't have access for lawyers for civil cases. But what is the dynamic now? Where are we right now in this conversation?
The idea of a civil Gideon has been gaining ground. After the 2008 financial crisis, when there was more foreclosure and eviction cases in going through housing court, while at the same time funding for legal aid was down, it drew attention to the fact that this was a critical life issue. Eviction is one of the foremost causes of homelessness. The difference between what's handled in criminal courts and civil courts is actually fairly arbitrary. When you hear that tape and the types of threats that are being made to Cesar and his family, it sounds like harassment, and it sounds to me like something that might be handled in criminal court.
Even domestic violence cases, which I remember when we were prepping for this story, I said, well, domestic violence can't be handled in a civil court. It's got to be in a criminal court. But in fact, it's handled oftentimes in civil court.
Exactly.
Thank you for your reporting on this.
Thank you, Maria.
Coming up on Latino USA. Dairy workers fighting for their rights in Vermont. Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Latino USA podcast. Here are a few questions for you, though. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals, or that John Waters was a judge at the pornography Oscars? Well, you would know that if you listen to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and you'll discover new ones to follow. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. And Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S, with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions, at inadausa.com. That's INADAUSA.com.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Earlier in our show, we talked about the court system and people fighting for their legal rights. Now we're in Vermont, where dairy workers are agitating for their right to fair working conditions without having to go to court. Milk with Dignity is a campaign asking for things like minimum wage and paid sick leave for dairy workers. Instead of pressuring state agencies to step up enforcement, they're going directly to corporations. Aileesha O'Neill has our story.
I'm Kara Cassier. I'm from Winooski, Vermont. I'm having a cookie milkshake.
My name is Hannah Little. I'm also from Winooski, Vermont, and I am enjoying a chocolate fudge brownie ice cream.
My name is Linda Keene. I'm from Old Town, Maine, and I'm having a vanilla salted caramel blondie.
It's a beautiful day outside the Ben & Jerry's Scoop Shop in downtown Burlington on Cherry Garcia Street. A perfect day for ice cream.
I'm Justin, and I'm from Bristol, Connecticut. My favorite ice cream is the brownie one, whatever it is. So,
is that what you just ate?
Yeah. I had a bowl. I don't like cones because they make a mess.
Here's the thing. Putting the cream in the ice cream takes a lot of hard work. And it starts here, on a dairy farm in northern Vermont.
Me levanto a las 4 en punto de la mañana.
23-year-old Arnulfo Ramirez gets up at 4 o'clock sharp every morning to hook up the milking machines.
En este rancho hay como 325 vacas.
Ramirez herds 325 cows into the milking barn in 6 shifts.
Trabajo 7 horas y media en la mañana.
It takes him 7.5 hours without a break. One day, things went wrong.
Una vez estaba trabajando y...
That day, when Ramirez was working, a motorized gate ran over 3 of his fingers.
Nadie quien podía ocupar mi turno porque mi patrón decía que...
They swelled up so much he couldn't work, he says. His boss said he couldn't find another worker.
Lo que ocupaba mi turno es mi mismo hermano.
So Ramirez's brother covered for him, working two shifts a day.
Ya cumpliendo los tres días tenía que trabajar.
After 3 days, Ramirez started working again.
Aunque con dolor, pero
still in pain, aguantaba. He says. But his brother couldn't keep working 15-hour days. Even if you don't get injured, milking cows is still hard work. Lorenzo Alculia, a 23-year-old from Tabasco, Mexico, is doing his laundry on his day off. He's worked on 10 dairies in 4 years. One of them was particularly bad.
Trabajábamos 13 horas. Teníamos solo un turno de descanso por quincena.
Alculia worked 13-hour days, he says, and he lived in a decrepit trailer infested with bed bugs and rats.
Donde vivíamos habían chinches. La casa era una traila.
At least half of Vermont's dairy workers, about 1,700 of them, are migrants. They're mostly from Mexico, some from Central America, young and male, many undocumented. They're crucial to the state's dairy industry, and dairy is crucial to the state's economy. It draws in over $2 billion every year, three-quarters of Vermont's farm income. Diane Bothfeld, Deputy Secretary of the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, says all workers are entitled to the same protections under state law, regardless of immigration status. But the law isn't always enforced.
There's kind of that bell curve out there where some people are doing a great job following all the regulations. And of course, there's that middle that are doing a pretty good job. You know, some are doing better than others. And then there's, of course, some areas where there's a lot of room for improvement.
There is a sense sometimes, you know, this is just the way it is. You know, suck it up, endure hardship, find a better job.
Brendan O'Neill's an organizer with Migrant Justice, a migrant dairy workers group based in Burlington. He claims 40% of the state's migrant dairy workers don't get paid minimum wage or even get a day off every week. 30% work 7 or more hours without a break.
And we're trying to change that so that all the farms, starting with Ben and Jerry's supply chain, provide dignified livelihoods for employees on those farms, but also for the farmer.
So why Ben and Jerry's? Well, it's a big player in Vermont's dairy industry. It buys cream from nearly half of the state's 850 dairies. But the workers on those dairies don't get any of the payout, O'Neill says.
They are excluded from many things, from collective bargaining, from minimum wage, from overtime. So where do you find that power? I think in such a corporate-controlled economy, you hold the corporations accountable who are profiting not only from the work, but the image that they project about being socially responsible.
That's the idea behind Milk with Dignity. Migrant Justice wants Ben and Jerry's to pay an extra premium to farmers who treat their employees well. The inspiration for this strategy came from Florida's tomato pickers, who got companies to pay slightly more for tomatoes picked by well-paid workers.
Ranging from Taco Bell to Walmart. I mean, these are big companies.
Ben and Jerry's initially declined to sign a similar agreement with Migrant Justice. Rob Mahalik, Ben and Jerry's global social mission director, says the company wanted to incorporate the basic tenets of Milk with Dignity into its own policies instead.
We said, well, we need to talk about this because we think we need to have the farmers in this discussion, since the farmers are actually the party that would employ the labor. Wouldn't it be better to get us all at the table?
But that never happened. After 6 months of talks that went nowhere, Migrant Justice launched a public nationwide campaign. Supporters held rallies outside 17 scoop shops across the country, including the Ben and Jerry's near New York's Times Square. Last month, Ben and Jerry signed an agreement with Migrant Justice, saying it'll work toward a legally binding commitment to guarantee a decent livelihood to the workers in its supply chain. If the agreement works and other companies sign on, it could have a far-reaching impact. That's good news for someone like Lorenzo Alculia.
Estamos en eso y seguimos adelante con lo que es la campaña de leche con dignidad.
We're at the beginning of the campaign, and we're going to keep moving forward, Alculia says. The corporation is the one that benefits from the milk products, the one that makes a profit. So it's the corporation, he says, that can change everything. For Latino USA, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Burlington, Vermont.
While dairy workers in Vermont fight for their labor rights, in Washington, D.C., a Latino lawyer fights to protect the civil rights of all Americans. In 2011, Marty Castro, a prominent lawyer from Chicago, became the first Latino to head the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights since it was created in 1957. Throughout its history, the commission has played a key role in crafting landmark civil rights legislation, from the Voting Rights Act to the Americans with Disabilities Act. Under Marty Castro's tenure, the commission has delved into issues like police relations with communities of color, school bullying, and the conditions of detainees at immigration detention centers. In fact, I testified for the commission in a January hearing on this issue because of my own extensive reporting on the topic for Latino USA and for Frontline on PBS. But I invited Marty Castro to join us on Latino USA to talk about where he came from and how he got to where he is today.
The first step was to become a commissioner. And so I had to be vetted by presidential personnel in order for President Obama to appoint me. And once I was appointed, the president decided to elevate me to chairman because there was no chair at the time. That made me the first Latino chairman of the United States Commission on Civil Rights since its inception in 1957. And to be appointed by the first African-American president, to me, that's what the American dream is all about.
Did you kind of look at yourself and say, you know, how did a Mexican kid from Chicago end up doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I got escalofríos back then, and I get them now as I'm thinking about it. I mean, my grandparents came from Mexico in the 1920s to Chicago with literally nothing, not even a formal education. But they knew that if they made it to this country, they could work hard and make something of themselves and their children, and maybe one day their grandkids. The same reason my mom came in 1960, looking for opportunity. She didn't have more than a sixth grade education. But they instilled in us the importance of education, the importance of being involved in your community. And here I am now, sitting under the seal of the great country, the great United States, a country which they came to and adopted them. And now to be serving it in this role, just to me, really what our families came here for, what our communities strive for. It's to find success in this country at the highest levels, but then to do something where you get to give back. You get to invest in the communities that you come from. You get to protect those communities. You get to speak for those communities.
How did you come to understand the role, your role in American democracy?
So I grew up in a very politically active community and family. When my dad ultimately wanted to run for office, the original Mayor Daley was still mayor. And back then you had to go ask for permission. And so he went to ask Richard I for permission to run for alderman at city council in Chicago. And then the day that meeting happened, my dad came home and he was very sullen. And I said, "What happened, Pa?" And he said, "Well, the mayor said I can't run for alderman." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, the mayor said I'm Mexican and Mexicans don't vote, so I can't run." And I was devastated by that. And as a 10-year-old kid, I vowed then, you know what, I will never, ever be in that position myself. A few years later, Mayor Daley dies. My dad runs against Mayor Daley's handpicked ward committeemen. They were the people that ran the political machine at the time, and putting a coalition together of African Americans, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, and the Polish and Eastern European vote in our ward, he beat the sitting incumbent. And that taught me a lot. It taught me that you could bring people together and overcome the odds and do things that people will tell you you couldn't do. But also, the people that I saw that were running the city of Chicago, the people who were influencing national politics from a perch on LaSalle Street, were all lawyers, and they all did not look like us. They were mostly white men. And I thought, you know what? I want to be a lawyer just like them because I want to be able to have an impact on my community. I want to be able to make decisions that affect my people.
So when you think about where you started and kind of where you are now, you know, living in a very affluent suburb with a solid job, you know, having major impact on the national scale, do you sometimes think it's hard to stay connected?
I mean, I'm fortunate that I get to move through various worlds. I get to be in the grassroots of our community, and I also get to walk through the C-suites of this country. I get to go to the White House, but I also go back to my neighborhood. I have been fortunate to be able to, in those travels back and forth, to see a lot. But I have never forgotten where I come from. In fact, if you ask me, I still view myself as that kid from South Chicago. from those rough and tumble streets. And many, unfortunately, of our Latino success stories, I've met a lot of them who forget where they came from. And to me, that is one of the worst things you could do. So it's key to ensure that even though those of us who have, quote unquote, succeeded, that we don't forget where we came from and make that contribution back, because I would say that would be not a success, but a failure.
Chairman and Commissioner Marty Castro, thank you so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you for doing this, for having our voice here.
Marty Castro is the first Latino chairman of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. And now, from civil rights to the broadest class of rights, which are human rights, the rights that we have simply because we're human beings. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a document that recognizes the inalienable rights everyone is born with. Now, an art project called Human Rights Tattoo aims to bring attention to the need to protect human rights. Participants get a single character from the document tattooed on their body. So when it's finished, the declaration will literally be written on 6,773 people around the world. For today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom, we hear from a few of them.
I really wanted to unite people on a really human level, and there are a few things that really should unite us, and the Declaration of Human Rights is one of those. It's universal. It should be universal. You have these rights because you are born human. And if we ask people, do you know what human rights are, we get some answers, but a lot of them not complete or not correct.
So would you like it right here?
Yeah.
And you want it, you want it over this?
Yeah.
Okay.
A tattoo can be like a conversation piece or just to bring up the subject and to raise awareness. A lot of people choose to have a tattoo as a personal reminder as well.
You ready?
Yes.
So I'm gonna do one little line and then I'll stop for a second.
I always wanted my first tattoo to have some kind of meaning.
It really hurts, but I can do it.
And I can't think of a better meaning than being united for this cause, for human rights. Every person should be valued for who they are and what they've created themselves to be, and to have the freedom to create themselves in whatever way they choose.
All right, we have an L.
Yes!
Okay, so let me wipe it off. And then
I'm a teacher now, and part of my daily struggle is to remember every day to love everyone around me, even if they're getting on my last nerve.
This letter is part of Article 16 that is all about the freedom to marry. And it's incredible that I just got that letter without even choosing it. But it touches so much on who I am as a person and the fight that I fight. When you experience oppression in your own life, you know, it makes you open your eyes to understand all forms of oppression. After that, closing your eyes again is truly impossible.
We live in a world where the Declaration of Human Rights right now doesn't have an effect. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have it as an ideal.
What really fuels the human rights movement, though, is the people on the field fighting, working, you know, talking to people, telling their stories. That's the real Declaration of Human Rights.
Artist Sander Van Bussel, the creator of Human Rights Tattoo, and participants Stephanie Betances, Catherine Betances, Diego Parra, and Cristina Miliu Teoharaki. That piece was produced for us by Isabel Rio Frio. And dear listeners, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Julia Alsop. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our Latino USA interns are Gabriela Sierra Alonso, Isabel Rio Frio, Polly Dinetclaw, and Nomin Ujiadin. Our futuro interns are Madeline Johnson, Sayer Devlin, and Francesca Santana. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Where Cesar rented to Jesus.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come. On the web at rwjf.org. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.